Musicpreneur.com.
I'm a messenger. I speak with integrity, truth, love, and light.
To assist in your journey of making money making music, the Musicpreneur.com podcast starts now. Here's your host, James Newcomb.
Welcome to the show. I'm James, and I'm glad you're here. Thank you for pressing play. Going to have a good time today. And we're going to celebrate the life of a fantastic musician, someone who is groundbreaking and someone who inspires musicians to this day, someone who thought outside the box, someone who pushed the envelope, as it were. Of course, we're talking about Jaco Pastorius. A couple of housekeeping announcements before we get into that. I have prepared for you guys a course. A course is a course, of course, of course. And everyone is giving away a course, and I've decided I'm going to give away a course too. It's on the Musicpreneur lifestyle. I have identified five key areas that we must master, not just be familiar with, but master in order for us to live the life that we were meant to live. Those are, of course, expert musicianship, business savvy, health, meaning physical, mental, spiritual, and emotional health, financial wellness, and education on the principles of the free market and capitalism. That is me. That is what I believe is going to make a well-rounded, wholesome individual who is going to make a career of music, not just any old career, not just playing for the contractors and playing for the gigs that already exist, but getting those gigs that you really want to get. Like, deep down in your mind, you have a gig that you really, really desire. And it's not going to happen if you don't take action, and it's not going to happen if you don't work on yourself. Well, this course is a little bit of just a taste of what I believe is some of the essential elements of those five key areas. And you can find it on the show notes for this episode, which is musicpreneur.com/Jaco. That's spelled J-A-C-O. So musicpreneur.com/Jaco. You're going to see a place where you can just sign up, enter your email address, and you're going to have it delivered right to your email inbox. There's going to be one per day. It'll take you 5 days, well, 6 days if you include the introductory email. But it's going to be 6 days. It's just going to give you a little taste of what I have come to believe is essential to be a successful musicpreneur. So, musicpreneur.com/Jaco or musicpreneur.com/course will take you right to the little informational page for that course. musicpreneur.com/course. All right, let's get down to business here. This is something that I've wanted to do for the better part of a year. I had Corey Brown on the podcast in, I guess I want to say, the summer of 2017. And it was for the purpose of discussing like boring business stuff. Corey is he's an expert on web development and really optimizing your website. But the meat and potatoes of the interview is about Jaco Pastorius. Corey is the curator. He is the founder. He is the proprietor of JacoPastorius.com. It's a website that is dedicated to preserving the life and the legacy of the great Jaco Pastorius. And before I had spoken to Corey, I suppose I may have heard the name once or twice, just in passing. I suppose I may have heard it, but I you know, I didn't know the first thing about Jaco Pastorius being a trumpet player, a classical trumpet player at that. So I was woefully ignorant when it came to this great person who played the bass and revolutionized the way that the bass is played. And even today, here in 2018, some of the world's greatest bass players trace their influence and their inspiration back to Jaco Pastorius. He was that influential. And that's why I wanted to talk about Jaco on this podcast, is just because if we want to, let me put it this way. What we really want to do is not just to make music, and it's not just to get gigs, and it's not just to make money with our music, but it should be to make an impact. An impact leads to dollars. I mean, it's the money is a means to an end, and that is to make an impact. And when the bigger impact that you make, well, if you're wise about it, then the more money you're going to make and you're going to be able to keep. Well, unfortunately, Jaco, he wasn't, although he was a great bassist, he wasn't the best at money management. And well, what I'm going to do is, before I get into my chat with Corey Brown, I am going to just read the bio or the life story of Jaco from the website, jacopastorius.com. I read it, and I thought, rather than have Corey, give a 30-second synopsis of Jaco Pastorius' life, which wouldn't do it justice, I decided that I'm just going to read the life story that he has on his website of Jaco, and then we're just going to get right into the interview. And you'll already have kind of the synopsis of his life, so you have that as a frame of reference. And then we're going to talk about a little bit more in detail of his legacy and his contributions to the bass world. So here we go. This is the life story of Jaco Pastorius, followed by my conversation with Corey Brown. Jaco Pastorius, the man who revolutionized how the bass guitar is played and who is for many the best and most influential bass guitarist ever, didn't start his musical life on the instrument. Instead, the man who would be the master of the fretless electric bass was a drummer. A drummer just like his dad, Jack Pastorius, a big band player and singer. Jaco was the first of three children born to Jack and his wife Stephanie. He arrived on December 1st, 1951 in Norristown, Pennsylvania, near Philadelphia. John Francis Anthony Pastorius III was quickly given a nickname by his parents, Jaco, which transformed into Jaco, J-A-C-O, in the early 70s when a French-born musician friend and neighbor, Alex Darkey, spelled it that way by mistake. Jaco liked the alternate spelling and kept it. When Jaco was almost 8 years old, his family moved to Oakland Park, Florida, near Fort Lauderdale. Jaco was a sweet, competitive kid who loved to play games, including football. As the son of a musician, he was interested in music too and bought a small drum kit with money earned as a newspaper delivery boy. His two interests collided in 1964 during a youth league football practice in which Jocko's wrist was badly injured, so much so that it eventually required corrective surgery. Jaco continued to play drums after that, but it was far more difficult than it had been prior to that hit in practice. Jaco becomes a bassist. Regardless, he got gigs as a drummer, and in 1966, while still in high school, he joined the soul cover band Las Olas Brass. When a more experienced drummer presented himself to the band, something fateful occurred. The band's bassist decided to move on at the same time. Although he wasn't a bass player, Jaco slid into the empty slot. He used money he earned as a paperboy to make another musical purchase. This time, he bought a new Fender Jazz bass. It was during this era that an inkling of Jaco's future abilities began to appear. He couldn't read music, but in 1968 he borrowed his friend Bob Bobbing's reel-to-reel tape recorder and created his version of The Chicken by Pee Wee Ellis. Jaco played all the instruments on the recording, which he sent to John Coltrane's widow, Alice, also an accomplished musician. She returned the favor by replying with an encouraging letter. In later years, The Chicken became one of Jaco's concert staples. With his interest in jazz, Jaco also acquired an upright bass. But it wasn't easy to maintain, and he eventually traded it for another electric bass guitar. Later, he would become known for getting an upright, like tone, on his fretless electric. Something else happened during this period of his life. He met a girl named Tracy Lee, who was destined to become his first wife. After the Las Olas Brass, Jaco moved on to playing in an R&B trio called Woodchuck. His bass playing grew while he was in the trio. His younger brother, Rory, recalls an exchange with Jaco, who was nearing his 18th birthday, detailed in Bill Mikowski's book, Jaco, The Extraordinary and Tragic Life of Jaco Pastorius. He looked me in the eye and said, real seriously, Rory, man, I'm the best player on earth. I'm the best bass player on earth. I looked back at him and said, I know. While Jaco was confident, he could also be humble. In his later career, he was known to say, I'm doing a very bad imitation on the bass of Jerry Jamot. During his Woodchuck days, Jaco also grew in another way. He became a husband and a father. He and Tracy married in August 1970, and their daughter Mary was born in December of that year, 8 days after her father's 19th birthday. He found a cruise ship gig for a bit, and his young family traveled with him in the Caribbean. Soon, another group came calling, a soul revue called Tommy Strand and the Upper Hand. His playing improved further with the group, but he really broke into new territory with the next band he joined, Wayne Cochran and the CC Riders. A whirlwind musical education and growth. He spent just five months in the R&B group fronted by white soul singer Cochran, and as he had on the cruise ship, he found a way for Tracy and their daughter Mary to travel with him at times. The couple didn't indulge in any wild behavior on the tour bus. Jaco didn't drink or do drugs, and instead practically lived with his bass in his hands. He learned to read music during his 1972 stint with the group. Band member Charlie Brent also gave Jaco an influential crash course in arranging. Brent remembers Jaco appearing with a chart for the band just 3 days after he and Brent had a long talk about arranging. It was gorgeous, Brent said. He was this raw talent evolving before our eyes. Cochran's long-running review was intense and is said to have inspired the John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd's creation of the iconic comic bluesmen, the Blues Brothers. As he developed as a bass player, Jaco had experimented with creating fretless basses. In the early 1970s, he acquired a 1962 Fender Jazz bass, which either Jaco acquired already fretless or from which he removed the frets with a butter knife. Jaco filled in the areas where the frets had been with plastic wood and coated the former fretboard with epoxy. This bass, which was primarily fretless instrument he recorded with, and Jaco nicknamed it the Bass of Doom. After his time with Cochran ended, he returned to Florida. He played with the Peter Graves Orchestra, connected with saxophonist and trumpeter Ira Sullivan, and met and first played jazz guitar great-to-be Pat Metheny. Jaco began playing a jazz group with Sullivan, and the quartet's sound, jazz but with funk and R&B influences, began to draw young fans. It also provided an outlet for Jaco's compositions, several of which, like Continuum, appeared on his first solo album. In 1973, Jaco and Tracy added another child to the family, John Francis Pastorius IV, and by that winter, Jaco had connected with jazz pianist Paul Blay. The following year, Jaco went into a studio and did a demo session featuring songs that would appear on his self-titled solo album. Jaco, Metheny, Blay, and drummer Bruce Ditmus created a joint album called Jaco in 1974. And during a trip to the famed Berklee College of Music in Boston, Jaco showed the students how he achieved his upright-esque sound on an electric. He even ended up teaching bass as an adjunct instructor in the University of Miami's jazz department, then headed by Bill Lee, father of another to-be-famous bassist, Will Lee, best known to general audiences for his work in late-night TV host David Letterman's house band. But Jaco didn't love teaching, and something was about to happen that changed his life. Bobby Colomby, the drummer and leader of Blood, Sweat, and Tears, was in Fort Lauderdale for a gig when he spotted Tracy Pastorius on the beach. He thought she was cute, and they began to talk. She told him that her husband is the best bass player in the world. Colomby was also seeking out artists for Epic Records' jazz division. He decided to see Jaco play. After watching him in action, he quickly offered Jaco a record deal. Jaco signed it in September 1975, and a month later, he was recording the album Jaco Pastorius. 1976, Jaco's watershed year. The album showed off Jaco in a wide range of styles, from Latin jazz to R&B to funk. Legendary R&B duo Sam and Dave handled vocals on Come On, Come Over. Herbie Hancock appeared on the album throughout. The composition, Portrait of Tracy, featured Jaco playing solo and making extraordinary use of harmonics. As the album was being recorded, Jaco made a foray into the rock world after meeting British musician Ian Hunter of Mott the Hoople and contributed the bass parts to Hunter's All-American Alien Boy solo album, which, like Jaco's solo debut, was released in 1976. America's bicentennial year also found Jaco being featured on Matheny's album Bright Size Life, recorded at the end of 1975. In the very active days of 1974 and 75, Jaco also communicated with Joe Zawinul, leader of jazz fusion band Weather Report. Upon meeting Zawinul after a 1974 Weather Report gig, Jaco introduced himself by calling himself the greatest bass player in the world. Zawinul didn't bite that time out, but after receiving an early mix of Jaco's solo album, he decided to call on the bass when Weather Report needed a bass player in late 1975. Jaco joined the group and was destined to add another significant record release to his 1976 watershed year. He played on two tracks on Weather Report's Black Market, Cannonball, and his own Barbary Coast. He remained with Weather Report through 1981, displaying both incredible musicianship and onstage showmanship. He was also a famed session player, most notably appearing on Joni Mitchell's Hegira and Don Juan's Reckless Daughter. In Mark Bago's biography, Joni Mitchell, the legendary singer-songwriter comments on her musical connection with Jaco. In a way, I feel like I dreamed Jaco. I mean, he was exactly what I was waiting for, sonically. With Weather Report, Jaco extended his musical reach. He was credited as a co-producer on the band's 1977 album, Heavy Weather, best known for the tunes Birdland and Jaco's Teen Town. The album made a huge splash and became a gold record in the year of its release. Unfortunately, by this time, Jaco's avoidance of alcohol and drugs came to an end. He began drinking and using cocaine. In 1978, Weather Report released Mr. Gone, which didn't receive the same accolades that Heavy Weather saw. However, Jaco's reputation as a bassist was sterling. Downbeat magazine readers and critics voted him their number one electric bassist that year. Jaco's and Tracy's marriage also ended in this period, with their divorce becoming final in early 1979. Jaco started exhibiting erratic behavior, evidenced by an extremely rough set at the February 1979 Havana Jam concert in Havana, Cuba, as part of the Trio of Doom, guitarist John McLaughlin, Jaco, and drummer Tony Williams. The year included the release of the live Weather Report album, 830, which showed off Jaco's chops in a concert setting. The year also featured a new beginning for Jaco. He married girlfriend Ingrid Horn Mueller in July, before heading out on tour with Joni Mitchell, whose touring band also included Matheny. While in Berlin that fall with Weather Report, he played a legendary solo bass concert on a day off. He was at the top of the bass world. In 1980, Weather Report released Night Passage, which included Jaco's classic ballad, Three Views of a Secret. He also signed a new solo deal, this time with Warner Brothers Records, and began recording his second solo album in August. Jaco's erratic stage behavior marred a performance with Weather Report in Japan in 1981, however. The year saw Jaco make his last recordings with Weather Report for the album Weather Report. His second solo album, Word of Mouth, also appeared that year. In this period, the psychiatrist father of Weather Report drummer Peter Erskine also suggested that Jaco might be manic depressive. By early 1982, Jaco had debuted his word-of-mouth big band, and on June 9th, his and Ingrid's twins, Julius Joseph and Felix Javier, were born. Unfortunately, he and Ingrid began growing apart, and Jaco began spending more time in New York City instead of the Florida world he knew better. The New York version of Jaco was different. His drinking and drug use continued unabated. His onstage behavior turned wild. During a tour of Japan, he threw his bass into Hiroshima Bay. Although Jocko contended he was fine, he went to Coral Ridge Psychiatric Hospital in Fort Lauderdale that September for a week's observation. He went out on tour not long after his release, and his combative behavior at an Italian concert turned the crowd hostile, with the event deteriorating into a riot in the middle of the show. Jocko intended for the record Holiday for Pans to be his word-of-mouth follow-up in 1983. The album demos featured steel pan music and no bass from Jocko. Warner Brothers declined to release the record and dropped him from the company's roster. And instead of Holiday for Pans, it released the live album, Invitation. Jocko, performing with the word-of-mouth band, turned in a confused performance at the 1984 Playboy Jazz Festival at the Hollywood Bowl. Depending on the night, he could turn in an inspired performance or a messy one as he played gigs with the word-of-mouth gig band or other artists. His mood swings came with the territory for those who knew him. By the following year, he and Ingrid were divorced. Losing the base of doom and a mental decline. In this disjointed era, Jocko's base of doom was effectively destroyed. Jocko sent it to Kevin Kaufman and fellow luthier Jim Hamilton in 1986 for refurbishment. Shortly after it was returned to him, again in working order, it was stolen in Greenwich Village. Jocko, who often left the base unattended as he played basketball games or slept in a New York park, never saw it again. The base was only recovered in 2007. It's now owned by Metallica bassist Rob Trujillo. Jocko's bassist son, Felix, had the opportunity to play it on a couple of tracks on the Yellow Jackets album, A Rise in the Road. It was a bit of a struggle to get through, just emotionally and because of what was involved, Pistorius said in an interview with Wayne Lockwood of the New York Daily News. Trujillo has told the family it can buy the bass for the same undisclosed price he paid for it. In the meantime, Trujillo, who has also produced a documentary about Jocko, is keeping the bass safe under lock and key in a Northern California vault. The mid-1980s were difficult for Jocko and those who loved him. He was evicted from his New York City apartment and crashed with friends for as long as he could. After a tumultuous visit to his father's home in Pennsylvania, Jocko briefly entered a psychiatric facility. The bassist didn't like the effects of the lithium given to him as treatment. He returned to New York and continued to play, but with his reputation for performances that could be inspiring one night but dispiriting the next, work was hard to find. Friends were saddened by his severe decline. In July 1986, Jocko was encouraged to check into the psychiatric ward of Bellevue Hospital. The diagnosis: Jocko was bipolar, or manic depressive. He stayed at Bellevue for 8 weeks and was released into the custody of a musician friend who took Jocko back to the San Francisco area with him, where the two worked on a record. At this time, Jocko's relationship with his girlfriend, Teresa, grew more volatile, and Jocko began drinking more. Teresa returned to New York after visiting San Francisco, and Jocko soon followed. Jocko played in New York and toured in Europe with a guitarist/bassist. 1987, Jocko's final year. Jocko started the year by moving back to Fort Lauderdale with his girlfriend, Teresa. Although he tried to regain stability, the old demons of mental illness reappeared, leading to many strange performances and even short stints in jail. Everything came to its tragic head in the early morning hours of September 12, 1987, when Jocko went to a bar called the Midnight Bottle Club, where he was ejected for his behavior. When he tried to kick the door back in, the club's manager, a third-degree black belt in karate, hit Jocko several times. Jocko's skull was fractured, and he suffered massive internal bleeding. He never left the hospital. On September 19th, he had a brain hemorrhage and went on a respirator. His family decided to remove him from life support on September 21st, and he died a little more than 3 hours later, with Tracy holding his hand. Jocko Pistorius was 35 years old. His assailant pled guilty to manslaughter charges and ultimately spent only 4 months in prison. Jocko is buried in Our Lady, Queen of Heaven Cemetery in North Lauderdale, and Jocko Pistorius Park opened in 2008 in Oakland Park. While his legacy lives on there, it's even more present in the legions of bassists inspired to play the instrument in a new way, or to play it at all, after hearing the work Jaco created during his prolific but all too short career. We're going to be talking about JacoPastorius.com, and I'm just going to be honest with you, Corey. Like, I'm a classical trumpet player. Well, I play a cornet more than trumpet these days, but I hadn't heard of Jaco Pastorius, to my shame, until you mentioned him last time we talked. I think it was last July we spoke, and you know, you mentioned what you were doing. You got this passion project, Jaco Pastorius, and you don't mince words. Like, well, I guess Jaco didn't mince words. He said, "I'm the greatest bass player in the world," but it turns out that a lot of people agree with him, including some of the best players, bass players in the world.
Absolutely.
Wow.
He's our Hendrix.
The Hendrix of bass.
That's right.
Well,
and I'm actually stealing that from a bass player named Juan Alberetti, who said that in an interview we did with him, where he said, you know, a bass player, very well-known bass player. That's his line. I have to give him credit. He said, "He is our Hendrix."
Wow. Well, I have already recorded some highlights of the bio of Jaco. So I just want to, so people have already heard about Jaco and the story, and he had such a great presence in the music community in the 70s and maybe early 80s. And it just, I don't know, when you hear stories like this, you don't know if you should be sad that he left this world so soon, or you should be just happy and glad that we had the small amount of time that we had with someone like that. What do you think about that?
I mean, I think that tells the Jaco story in a nutshell. You know, there's certainly a lot of tragedy there. But you know, what his output in a very, very short time, he was, I think, 35 when he was murdered. And you know, that, and the output in a very short career is, you know, astounding. And you know, what he did, you know, there's another quote, by another bass player that said there was bass before Jaco and there was bass after Jaco. And, you know, he redefined the instrument. You know, the electric bass, you know, is a relatively young instrument because it was, you know, it's been around, I think, since the 30s, but it was not popular or mass produced until Leo Fender started creating mass produced bass guitars in 1960, I believe. And so you think about, you know, Jaco, his first professional recording was, I think, 1976 that it was released. So you think about that, the bass, the electric bass as a mass produced instrument was maybe 16 years old at the time. And, you know, there was a lot of jazz people who looked down on the electric bass, bass guitar. You know, the double bass was it. And, you know, Jaco, you know, said somewhere along the lines, I'm out to make this non-instrument an instrument. And not only did he do that, but he redefined, you know, an instrument that had been used a lot in, you know, rock and pop and R&B and all that. But, you know, it just, you know, it was, the bass player was in the back of the band, you know, playing the standard lines. And, you know, he approached it like a horn player sometimes. He approached it like an R&B player sometimes. You know, he became the focal point. He became the front, you know, the lead instrument, which, you know, it doesn't sound so crazy now with what's happened to the bass, but it was absolutely, you know, unheard of when Jaco came out.
Well, you have some videos on this JacoPastorius.com, and one that I watched today was it was the Montreux Jazz Festival. How would you describe it? Was like, do you think like he had the same prominence in the band as like the lead guitar? Or because he certainly had that presence or that potential, but it just seems to me like the bass, you know, even though you have someone as good as Jaco and as someone with that presence, it's still not going to have the same oomph as like a lead guitar, or maybe a lead singer. How did he fit in with that?
Yeah, there's a lot of stories there, but I'll highlight a couple. I think, you know, one was, you know, so he, his first album is 1976, just titled Jaco Pastorius. It was his solo debut, came out on Epic Records. And, you know, I mean, it was so varied in the musical styles, and you know, there was R&B on it, there was jazz, and I mean, everything in between. And, you know, he was, you know, definitely the lead instrument. And there was a clip on there called Portrait of Tracy, which was, you know, for us bass players who were old enough, and you know, it was one of those, you know, jaw dropping moments. And many bass players have talked about that, where he played a tune with nothing but harmonics on the bass. And, you know, so, you know, it's, and I believe that's the one, where he opened, with, you know, just him on the bass and some congas, and then, you know, it's an R&B tune. And, you know, it was just, you know, just earth shattering for, you know, all of us bass players, especially. And then, you know, he recorded with Weather Report, and Weather Report was a band that, you know, as I understand it, cause you know, they kind of predate, I mean, they don't predate me in life, but they predate me before us, you know, into music. You know, my understanding was they sold out, like, you know, college venues, you know, kind of smaller clubs and that sort of thing. And, you know, Jaco joined the band. He was the third bassist for Weather Report, and they basically went, you know, like rock star status and started selling out huge venues, and they nicknamed Jaco the Catalyst, because, you know, what he added to the band and their direction with him in the band. And you know, he certainly wasn't a lead instrument in Weather Report. And there were certainly tunes that showcased him as the lead instrument, but, you know, he had four very, very strong musicians in that band that, you know, but the combination was, you know, really unbelievable, and they became huge. And, you know, the last story really is, I mean, there's a lot, but Joni Mitchell, you know, brought him in. And, you know, there's a lot of interviews with Joni talking about Jaco, where she talked about how, you know, she didn't really understand why the bass had to play the role it played, and she imagined it to do something else. But when she talked to bass players about it, they said, "You're crazy." You know, she said all these kind of, you know, quarter notes on, you know, around the root and the harmony and, you know, sort of traditional bass playing. You know, she didn't understand why the bass wouldn't go into the upper register or play more melodic or whatever. And I think it was Robin Ford that said, you know, "You got to check this guy out." She brought him in. They did four albums together. And, you know, I love Joni Mitchell. You know, I love all of her work. I consider that her best work. And just the way I've always described it is with Jaco and Joni, it was like two voices, you know, her voice and Jaco's bass, and just the interplay and the way Jaco, you know, approached that, very lyrical, you know, fretless bass too, and which was not very common back then.
Right. So yeah, this Joni Mitchell, she said she's the voice of why can't the bass do this, or why are basses not doing this? And then she's introduced to Jaco. Do I?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So it sounds to me like the bassists of the day, they didn't think. Like, maybe they were just had this little tunnel vision, or they just had these real small parameters of where they can, of what their instrument should do, or they're just kind of existing in this, well, this is what basses do, and that's, yep, just the way it is. And Jaco comes along and says, "No, you can do much more than that."
Absolutely.
Wow.
Yeah. And the best line, you know, in all those Joni interviews talking about Jaco is, like, basically she said it was as if I dreamed him, like that he wasn't real, you know.
Yeah, I think I saw that on, I think you wrote that on the bio. Mm-hmm. So you just, yeah, that's awesome. I'm looking at, I clicked on the Jaco Pastorius album, and I'm just looking at the musicians. He had Randy Brecker,
mm-hmm,
Herbie Hancock,
mm-hmm,
just A-list player after A-list player. And like, he's the headline. 1976, right. And it just reminds me, like, I talk to a lot of trumpet players, and I had a trumpet podcast about on the trumpet for about 2 years, and I see a lot of similarities with this. Like, the trumpet came into being probably around 1920, 1930. The cornet was the kind of like what the electric guitar is, and then the trumpet was kind of like just the worst players play the trumpet. You have someone like Harry James or Doc Severinsen come along and make it just transform how it's perceived among musicians. And it sounds to me like Jaco was like that guy that made bass, the electric bass, what it is today, or started that.
I certainly think so. I mean, there's, I think the majority of bass players would agree. You know, I always consider it like a family tree, you know, that Jaco certainly was influenced by other people. Not all bass players, but, you know, Jaco has influenced bass players whether they know it or not. You know, there's just this continual growth of the instrument. And people that, you know, look up to somebody today looked up to Jaco, you know, back in the day and took something from him. And so, you know, it's just, you know, but for me and for, like I said, a lot of people, you know, I think he was really the start of something new. When you look at, you know, Victor Wooten, who's very different from Jaco, but, you know, a very well-known solo bass player, you know, it's hard to say what would have happened, you know, but you know, for Jaco to open the door, and Stanley Clarke was another one, and he predated Jaco, you know, as being, you know, a solo bass artist, you know, in terms of he was the name, it was his album, he was a bass player, you know, but, you know, it was very, very unusual, very rare back in those days. And so, you know, these guys, you know, they will mention Jaco, they will mention Stanley Clarke as influences. And I think it, when you look at that, you know, to have the bass player, you know, moving out of the shadows to the back of the stage into the forefront, you know, people like Victor Wooten today, you know, certainly have taken that to a whole new level as a result.
And you might be able to say that without Jaco doing what he did when he did it, would Victor Wooten have the opportunity? Would he have the platform to do what he does?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say. You know, I know that, you know, Victor credits him and Stanley and I'm sure others as influences. You know, so it's hard to say, you know, what would have happened. I mean, Victor's the pinnacle for us now, you know, he's among the top players. So I don't want to take anything away from him, but, you know, like I said, I do consider it a family tree, and, you know, it's all kind of a descendant of each other.
Well, we'll just say that the bass was destined for greatness, and Jaco just happened to be the person. If it wasn't him, it would have been someone else.
Yeah.
Who were some of the people that influenced Jaco, whether bass or not, like musically?
Well, you know, his father was a performing drummer and singer. And so, you know, there's a lot, you know, Jaco basically, one of his lines was, "I know where I stole every note." And, you know, but he was, I mean, it's pretty nuts when you think about, like, so he lived in South Florida, Southeast Florida in Fort Lauderdale. And he was picking up like the Caribbean music and the steel drums. And, you know, he loved that, Cuban music. Stravinsky is listed, you know, he would list Stravinsky as an influence. He loved the R&B scene. And I know that Jerry Jamont, who was a session player for Atlantic Records in the 60s and 70s, who played with Aretha Franklin and B.B. King and, Ray Charles and a bunch of other, you know, acts everybody knows. You know, he was another guy that influenced Jaco. And you know, he didn't mention many bass players as influences, but Jerry Jamont was one of them. He loved Sinatra. You know, he loved, when you listen to his music, you see, like, it's hard to classify, and it's hard to certainly classify an album as to what genre is this, because it was so varied. But when you hear him, you know, back in the day talking about his influences, it starts to make sense that, you know, he drew from so much. And, you know, I really believe he just kind of blended all that stuff the way he wanted to blend it into the electric bass. And, you know, just that's why, you know, it's really hard to classify, you know, what he was in terms of a genre.
Wow. Well, I think I already asked you this, but how is it that, obviously, you being a bass player, that, I mean, that's mm-hmm. that's how we know you came to know of Jaco Pastorius, but when did you have this idea of starting this passion project, JacoPastorius.com? When did you have it, and why did it take so long for someone to do this? It seems to me like he was... tell me about it. Was he like kind of forgotten? I know that he lost his guitar, and it was recovered by Robert Trujillo. And mm-hmm. did he just kind of fall off the radar after his death? Or tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think he died in 1987, and I was 19 years old at the time. And I would say that at that time and ever since, you won't find a bigger Jaco nerd on the planet than me. I was just obsessed with his music and his playing, and he was an amazing writer and arranger as well. And, you know, I majored in music composition, so that was on my radar, you know, like his composition skills, as well as his bass playing skills. So, you know, you know, it's a little bit of a long story, but I'll try to keep it as short as possible. Sure. In 1998.
Take your time, man.
I had gotten into the web game in 95. And in 1998, and I guess for, you know, it had been up for a while. There was a coming soon page on JacoPastorius.com. And, you know, this is run by his family, the estate that eventually became Jaco Pastorius Inc. And, you know, it's his four children who run this, and his brother who's involved. And, you know, they were certainly, you know, working to, you know, keep his legacy alive. And, you know, in the jazz world and that sort of thing, you know, it's not, you know, he was not part of a Metallica, you know, he's not part of a you know, but, you know, for bass players and a lot of jazz enthusiasts, you know, he was known, but, you know, it's different than to, you know, a major rock band or something like that, in terms of, you know, how much of the general, it doesn't surprise me when you say you hadn't heard of him. I, you know, a lot of people I meet have never heard of him, outside of the bass playing world for sure. And so in 1998, you know, there was this coming soon page on JacoPastorius.com. It had been up for a while. And so, you know, I'm the kind of guy that just kind of, I look to create my own opportunities. And, you know, so I pulled the address off the domain record for JacoPastorius.com, it was a PO box, I think, in Florida. And I wrote him a letter and mailed it, didn't hear back, wrote him another letter, didn't hear back. And so... I think that was probably two, maybe three letters I wrote, and basically saying, you know, look, I'm a web guy, I'm a Jaco nut, I'd love to help you do this, love to help you get a site going. And so, you know, nothing really happened from that. And so it was December 2000. I'll never forget, I went out to the mailbox. Bass Player magazine was in the box and Jaco was on the cover. And, you know, the article was talking about something I had heard about for a while, but, you know, nobody really knew when this thing was going to come out. And it was called Portrait of Jaco, The Early Years. And it was a project that was being done by a guy named Bob Bobbing, who knew Jaco growing up and had a number of reel-to-reel tapes of Jaco before Jaco was famous. You know, bands he was in, home recordings he made, you know, the whole nine. And he was basically producing this early years box set that, you know, was going to kind of tell the story of Jocko before we knew who Jocko was. And so, of course, you know, at the end of the article, it's like, go to this website, check out the project. And I go to that website, it says coming soon. And, you know, I'm a web guy, I'm a marketer, and it had no like email capture on it to say, hey, we're not up and running yet, you know, but sign up and we'll email you when it's ready. So I did the same thing. I got the contact information off the domain record and emailed Bob and said, hey, you know, I'm not looking for anything, but you really should have an email capture. And I could do that for you if you'd like. And he responded like right away. We started talking on the phone every night and ended up flying down to Fort Lauderdale. And, you know, he played me a lot of the project. He did such an amazing job with it. But not only that, you know, he had this office, like a warehouse behind it, and it was a Jocko museum. You know, I'm looking through notebooks that Jocko was writing notes about albums that I have cherished for years, you know, like he was, you know, taking home the recordings and writing notes about what he wanted to do in the studio the next day. And, you know, some of his bass strings and tons of photos and contracts, and Grammy, you know, things, and, you know, just check stubs from all the record, you know, it was everything. And, you know, for me, I was just like, I just want to live in this warehouse for the next year and go through everything. And so, you know, basically Bob said, yeah, you know, help me with the website. But it turns out he also didn't have any of the packaging done. And the box set was going to have an 80-page full color booklet, a slipcase, a digipack, you know, basically art covered everything. Art covered the CDs, art covered the digipack, the sleeve, and this 80-page booklet. And, you know, so before the web, I was an art director, I was a graphic designer in print, and I said, hey, I can help you with that too. And so I ended up doing, you know, working with Bob to design and, you know, produced all the packaging that we ended up printing and when this thing went live. So that was, I guess, 2001 or so. I think we wrapped it up in 2003. And, you know, Bob is close with the family and said, basically, I said, you know, I used to write the family letters and, you know, they were having a hard time with the website, you know, back in those days, especially if you didn't know how to build a website, it was hard, and they did a good job, but they wanted to do so much more. And Bob, you know, called Jocko's kids and said, hey, you really should talk to this guy and let him do the site. And so I built the original, you know, I built the first Jocko site that I worked on with my team in 2002. And then 2007, you know, I was deep into the Squidoo project, and they ended up taking it over. And then when we sold Squidoo in 2014, that's when I came back and started doing it again. That's, like I told you, it's kind of a long story, but, you know, it was just kind of an organic thing that you know, brought me to doing that.
Well, you had to be persistent with it. And
yeah.
Because you had that love of Jocko, that's what you just like, it made sense to just keep doing it.
Yeah. You know, I've done talks on this before, trying to inspire, you know, certainly younger people who, you know, they're trying to build their career, you know, that it never hurts to ask. It never hurts to reach out. You know, I didn't do it because I wanted to make money, and I didn't, you know, it wasn't like a greedy thing. It was just like, you know,
it just had to be done.
I would love to be the guy that helps you get this off the ground and do that. And, you know, and so, you know, there was failure in there and that I didn't get a response, and there was success in there that it eventually worked out. And, you know, I just tell people, you know, you know, it doesn't always work, but when it does, you know, this is the kind of stuff that, you know, ends up, you know, mattering in your career.
Wow. Well, man, JockoPastorius.com is, I've spent a couple of hours on it today, and it's just so well done. So just a testament to your skills on the web, sir.
I appreciate that.
Love the fonts. I really like everything about it. And you don't have to be, you don't have to be a base geek to appreciate the website. Just listening to the story of Jocko gave me a lot of things to take away from it, just as a musician and as an entrepreneur. He had an entrepreneurial spirit. So go over there, JockoPastorius.com. Corey's got, we've got features, perspectives on Jocko. We've got film clips, videos, music. You've got all of these albums, and can we listen to all of them in their entirety?
There is a player built into they're clips.
Oh, they're clips. Okay.
And so, yeah, the 90-second clips, I think.
All right. So take a listen to the clip, and then you've got the links to buy them on all the major outlets, iTunes and whatnot. But man, thank you.
And I do want to say, if you don't mind, I do want to call out the film, that was, so Robert Trujillo, you mentioned, they found Jocko's bass, and he ended up getting it before it got purchased by somebody else and packaged up and sent into a vault somewhere. And Jocko's son has played it and actually recorded with it. But Robert actually did something that I think a lot of people said they were going to do, and I know over the years there's a lot of buzz about doing a Jocko film. But Robert actually did it. And so, I guess it came out 2, maybe 3 years ago now. And it's just called Jocko. And it's a documentary, tremendous film. And I got to connect with Robert, and what a fantastic human being. You know, documentaries are not money makers, and, but this was a passion project of his. But it's for people that, don't know him or know of him, it's a very powerful documentary, that, tells that kind of dichotomy of Jocko's life very well, in my opinion. And, it really, I think it paints the picture very well of his life and his impact and, everything that I was kind of talking about.
We even have hoodies and shirts. Yeah. This is awesome.
Yes. Yeah.
And a sticker. Wow.
A sticker, yeah.
Man, so go, you got to get over there, people. JockoPastorius.com. Corey, this has been a blast, and we'll probably have you back on to talk boring business stuff again. But this has been a lot of fun. I learned a lot. Thanks for being on the show.
Awesome. Thanks so much.